KZSU, Stanford University. Welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am a resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, and I thank you for listening in today. Today I'm interested and very excited in having on the director of the Project on Government Secrecy at the Federation of American Scientists, Steve Aftergood. FAS is the acronym I will use today, and FAS is an outstanding and fascinating organization with a very rich history that we'll go into a little bit with Steve. But one of the projects that they're working on, and they've been doing for a while, is focusing on government secrecy. And the basic idea, and I'll let Steve explain it in more detail, but the basic idea of the project is to really allow the public to get access to information that, for one reason or another, is difficult to get a hold of. So it ranges from everything from information that comes by way of Freedom of Information requests made, the acronym being FOIA, to international agreements. They also do wonderful work allowing the public to get access to Congressional Research Service reports that are difficult to get a hold of. So it's really an outstanding resource for the public generally, but especially for researchers and people like that that are trying to get a sense of what's going on. The shadows is a cliche term, but really information that's difficult or impossible to get. And Steve's project, the Project on Government Secrecy, allows for easy access to that information. We're going to talk to Steve today about some of the technology issues that arise in connection with government secrecy and FAS's efforts to get access to information, as well as learn more about the FAS generally and what the project is about, and kind of talk about some of these interesting issues. So I'm very excited to have Steve Aftergood on. By way of very brief background, Steve is the director of the project. He's a senior research analyst at FAS and directs the project. He has co-authored and authored numerous papers and essays in publications ranging from Scientific American to the Journal of Electrochemical Society, Issues in Science and Technology. And he also, from 1992 to 98, he served on the Aeronautics and Space Engineering Board at the National Research Council. FAS, like I said, really grew out of the Manhattan Project, and so it's a very interesting organization, and we will dive into it. But I'm very excited and thrilled to have Steve Aftergood on, the director of the Government Secrecy Project at FAS. It's an outstanding effort that they're performing and an enormous public service that they've put together. And so after the music break, I'm very excited to start the conversation with Steve. Speaking of talking, if I've done my job properly, at the other end of the line, indeed on the other side of the country, is Steve Aftergood. Steve, are you there?
I am, yes.
Terrific. Well, thank you for being here today, and especially up front, I'll just reveal my, as I did in the introduction, reveal my complete bias here in favor of the work that you're doing. I think it's an enormous public service, and so thank you very much for taking the time today to be on Hearsay Culture.
Thank you.
Let's start off with, for the listeners that aren't familiar with FAS, maybe we could just start with the basic question, which is, what is the Federation of American Scientists, and what is its background?
Yeah. Well, the Federation is what nowadays is called a think tank. It basically does policy research and advocacy, mainly on issues of national security, arms control, and so forth. It grew out of an organizing effort by Los Alamos scientists immediately after the end of World War II. Manhattan Project scientists were concerned about the political implications of the nuclear weapons that they had helped to create, and they wanted to help set up political structures to manage and control, if not disarm, the nuclear arsenals that were then starting to grow. Since that time, FAS has been active on various arms control issues and other aspects of national security policy, including, in my case, working to reduce and overcome government secrecy.
Is FAS a membership organization, or how does it structurally, how does it operate?
It is a membership organization. It used to have chapters around the country decades ago. But now, today, there's just the headquarters office in Washington, D.C., and several thousand scientists and non-scientist members who subscribe to our publications and otherwise support the organization.
The your background in this area, what is your background beyond what I described, and how did you get into being involved in this project?
Well, way back when, I used to be an electrical engineer. Somewhere along the line, I got interested in policy work and advocacy, which to me seemed much more rewarding. But my first encounter with official secrecy, my first close encounter, you might say, was in 1991. I was working on the policy surrounding the use of nuclear power sources in space, both for exploration and also potentially for use in orbiting weapons platforms or other military systems. And out of the blue one day, somebody sent me in the mail a stack of classified documents concerning a secret program to develop a nuclear reactor-powered rocket.
Huh.
It was called Timberwind. And basically, it was they leaked it to me. It was a violation of all kinds of rules, but it got my attention. And more than that, it got me wondering about why this information was classified, who classified it, what are the rules governing the system, and a host of other questions that I've been pursuing ever since.
Of course, I would imagine at any time that one receives an unsolicited stack of classified documents, you'd have to be immediately impressed with where this came from and how it came about. As an aside, before we get into the project on government secrecy, I had on Anne Finkbeiner, who wrote a very interesting book on the history of the Jasons,
yeah,
and which I'm sure you're familiar with. And I'm curious to know, it's a slight deviation from discussing government secrecy, but I want to get your sense of it. The FAS's background, as you described it, and its development has often been viewed from the standpoint of the development of the atomic bomb, et cetera, and so forth. And I'm curious, in relation to the issue of secrecy, in your experience, how willing are the scientists that you deal with and the people that you talk to at FAS, not internally, but I'm saying generally, when you do the research on secrecy, how sympathetic are scientists that you talk to the project that you're working on?
In my experience, there has been overwhelming sympathy.
Mm-hmm.
I think scientists probably are biased in favor of openness. I mean, open publication and peer review are axioms of scientific practice, and secrecy is pretty much antithetical to the way scientists think of themselves and the way they do their work. So there's a prejudice in favor of trying to reduce secrecy. That does not mean that scientists are undisciplined. Many of our members hold security clearances. I do not. And they honor the commitments they make when they sign non-disclosure agreements.
Hmm.
But that doesn't stop them from criticizing the system. Almost everybody who has given thought to the way the secrecy system today operates concurs that it has grown top-heavy, it has gotten too big, and that it's on the verge of undermining its own effectiveness simply by growing out of reasonable proportions.
It's interesting because with respect to scientists that are working on government contracts, a la the Jasons, there is this conflict, which I find interesting, between the publication and dissemination of information ethic that exists in the sciences with the practical realities or perhaps non-realities that are foisted upon scientists when they get involved in classified and other secret-type work. So it's interesting that the overwhelming support that you're describing at FAS, because one could imagine perhaps a group of scientists that are more sanguine about the work that you're doing. Let's talk in that vein more specifically about the project. So for the listeners again who are not familiar, what is the project on government secrecy?
Well, it's an effort to highlight the secrecy system that pervades the U.S. government and to some degree to overcome it. We highlight it by tracing its contours, by showing just how far secrecy has gotten into the political process, where many of the barriers to access lie, often in unexpected and sometimes irrational places. And we try also to go beyond that and to fix parts of the problem that we are able to. And we do that by endeavoring to gain access ourselves, including sometimes unauthorized access, to certain documents that are not readily accessible, and making them available.
Is the purpose of the project, or let me put it another way, is there an underlying theory or ethic that FAS brings to this project?
Well, if you mean a theory of the secrecy system, mm-hmm. then I guess the answer is yes. Very briefly, the way I think of it is that there are three major strands, if you will, to the secrecy system and the way that it's practiced. In the first place, there are legitimate and genuine national security secrets. And I don't know anybody who disputes that. Design details for advanced military technologies. No one says those should be openly published. The identities of confidential intelligence sources. Nobody says, sure, go ahead and publish those. There are several categories of such information that are properly kept secret, and when they are kept secret, that serves the public and the national interest. So that's one strand. The second strand, however, is what I would call bureaucratic secrecy. And that's the sort of mindless hoarding of information that typically characterizes bureaucracies and other large organizations. They will, as a default, they will simply hold on to information and not release it. And if you say, well, can I have this? They will say, either they'll say no, or they'll say, why do you want to know? What's your agenda? Are you going to hurt me? Or are you going to help me? In any case, the first reflex of the bureaucrat is to hoard information, even if it doesn't serve his or her interest to do so. And finally, what the third strand, and probably the smallest proportionately of the three, is the political abuse of secrecy authority, in which secrecy is used to conceal embarrassing facts or to avoid unwanted controversy. That is not what the secrecy system was created for. It was created to protect national security, but from time to time one finds, or one doesn't find, but nevertheless is true, that secrecy is used as a political instrument to gain political advantage or to avoid controversy. And that's completely illegitimate and something, of course, that we try to expose. oppose and overcome.
There, and what I find interesting, and I think we can explore in a little more detail, are the motivations that you've mentioned at each strata of secrecy that you describe, because clearly the bureaucratic effort or the bureaucratic reflex, as you describe it, to keep information secret probably derives from a different set of concerns than the political secrecy that you've identified. And I think I want to get into that a little bit, but for the benefit of the listeners, to get an underpinning of what we're talking about, perhaps you could describe, you mentioned how you got involved interested in issues of government secrecy, but perhaps you could describe for listeners how the project itself started and what its antecedents were.
Well, way back, the antecedents of the project really coincide with the origins of the organization, because much of the secrecy, the government secrecy system as we know it today, has its roots in the Manhattan Project. The notion of secret budgets, large secret allocations of money, really has its roots in the Manhattan Project. The idea of compartmentation of information, in which even cleared persons are only given access to certain information and not other information, was really refined and brought to a level of sophistication in the Manhattan Project. Unacknowledged programs, cover stories, all of these things were practiced with new sophistication for the first time by the Manhattan Project, and they're still with us today. But the project that I work on in the early 90s followed on this disclosure to me, this leak of the secret nuclear rocket program. Because one of the first things that I did was to file a complaint with the Department of Defense Inspector General, arguing that this program should not have been a secret, unacknowledged program.
Uh-huh.
It might have been a good idea, it might have been a bad idea, but there was no basis for denying its existence. And after more than a year of investigation and review, the Inspector General finally came back and said, well, that's correct. At a time when Edward Teller's X-ray laser, which is powered by a nuclear explosive, that concept is not classified. There was no legitimate reason to classify the concept of a nuclear reactor-driven rocket,
uh-huh.
And the Department of Defense went overboard in this case. So that experience taught me that secrecy was something that one could do something about, that, you know, you didn't just have to shake your head and say, man, this stinks. You could actually, there are the tools with which to affect policy and to alter policy are still within reach, and so that whole episode to me was a source of inspiration and energy, and something that I've been following up on ever since.
Is there a staff connected with the project?
I am the principal staffer. I have sort of infrastructure support from the Federation of American Scientists, and from time to time some staff support. So it's a pretty I don't know if I'd call it a shoestring operation, but we're lean. Lean.
Right. Yeah, and that's something with which I'm familiar. I found very few public interest organizations that had manpower galore, so it's always a challenge.
Yeah, and I think they work best that way. Mm-hmm. I think if you have more people than you know what to do with, then you're in trouble.
Right. Let's get into some of the where we are today type questions and get into those areas. The clearly secrecy and government secrecy, I think, is more on people's radar screen post-September 11th than it was prior. And, you know, there's a real interesting, I think, public debate about whether it's good that the government is keeping national security information secret or not. As you mentioned, national security information has certainly more ready and more ascertainable bases for secrecy. And I want to put that aside for the moment and ask a general question, which is, in your experience dealing with these issues on a day-to-day basis, is government secrecy, and is the government relying upon secrecy more today than it was in the past? And I guess I'll split that into two parts. First, comparing it pre and post September 11th, but also slightly more nebulously, pre and post the advent of the Internet itself as a public resource.
Well, let me split up my answers.
Sure. We'll do it like quiz show.
Certainly, by every available measure, secrecy has increased sharply during the George W. Bush administration. There's an organization called the Information Security Oversight Office, which is a federal agency that monitors classification activity. And they reported that in recent years, the pace of classification activity, the number of new classification decisions, has reached record heights. There's just more people classifying more information than ever before. That's an objective fact. More than that, one finds new controls on unclassified information,
mm-hmm.
such that information that used to be available to the public suddenly no longer is. For example, years ago I used to go to the government printing office bookstore and buy copies of agency telephone directories, like the Department of Defense phone book, and which is a great resource because it both helps you understand how these massive organizations are structured, and it helps you find the people you may want to find for whatever reason. After 2001, the DoD telephone directory suddenly was marked for official use only.
Huh.
It ceased to be available. It recently has come back in a greatly truncated form, such that it's almost useless. But my point is that a new wall has come up between government and the public that did not used to exist. It has, you know, the government has basically said, we don't want to hear from you, and we don't want you to know how to contact us,
mm-hmm.
except in the most, you know, vague and general terms. It's a real setback for reporters and for people who do or want to interact with the government on a regular basis. So yeah, secrecy has really reached new proportions. And you know, in fairness, it's important to acknowledge that the security environment has changed.
Mm-hmm.
There are heightened sensitivities that did not exist prior to 9/11, and it's reasonable that all of our security policies would be reviewed with that fact in mind. Nevertheless, it is also true that secrecy has accelerated far beyond what the potential threat of terrorism might justify. It has gotten into, you know, all kinds of mundane and benign areas where information has just become harder and harder to obtain.
And in the Internet itself, of course, the cliche of the information superhighway is kind of gone away largely, but we're still looking and certainly scholarship is focusing on the idea of networks and sharing information as a basis for creating commodities, as well as disseminating knowledge. And certainly, obviously, secrecy stands in the way of that, but more specifically, the idea that the government at the same time will be attempting to rein in information made accessible leads to some, I think, some bad outcomes in terms of public decision-making and things like that. How, in terms of the advent of the Internet, and I'll make it more specific and define that basically as around the time of the dot-com boom, as when the Internet really became this function of commerce. Do you sense that there has been a change in vis-a-vis the use of the Internet and government secrecy?
Yeah, I mean, the answer really depends on what your timeline is.
Mm-hmm.
If the question is how do things today compare to 3 or 5 or 7 years ago, there has been a retreat from the Internet in many parts of the government. Numerous websites, literally thousands of websites in the .gov and .mil domains have shut down. Many others have been removed behind password-protected portals. And a lot of information, as I said, that formerly was available no longer is. If the question is how do things compare to where they were 10 and 15 years ago, then I'm old enough to remember, and my project really began before the advent of the World Wide Web, and I can remember before there was a C-SPAN. And there's no question that we are blessed or cursed with a tremendous abundance of information that 15 and 20 years ago was simply not available,
mm-hmm.
or at least not available to non-professionals outside of Washington, D.C. So we're still, we're still reaping the benefits of technological openness, I suppose you'd call it.
Mm-hmm.
But there has been a bit of a pendulum swing, and instead of moving forward, we're taking some steps back. And that, again, I think there are cases where that might be justified.
Mm-hmm.
Government reviewers found that in many cases agencies had been very careless in what they posted on their website. There was lots of personal information, home addresses and phone numbers, social security numbers, and they eventually moved in to take away as much of that stuff as they could find. And I don't think anybody objects to that. I think that's perfectly understandable.
Mm-hmm.
The problem, though, is that they also took away a lot of other stuff that arguably does belong in the public domain. And that's where we are trying to push back as much as we can and to get that information back in the public domain.
When we're going to take a very short music break, but when we return, I want to pick up on that and talk about this bureaucratic secrecy idea and concept that you discussed earlier, because clearly a painting with a broad brush in terms of what should be made public seems to be almost not only a process that bureaucracy engages in, but also a matter of erring on the side of caution, to put it nicely, or just trying to limit public scrutiny of the internal workings of government, to put it more cynically. And I do want to talk about that bureaucratic secrecy idea, as well as some of the impacts of technology that may or may not be counterintuitive to the listeners with regard to secrecy. So you're listening to Hearsay Culture on KZSU Stanford, and when we return from the music break, we will continue the conversation with Steve Aftergood of the Federation of American Scientists Project on Government Secrecy.
Before we come back with Steve Aftergood from FAS, it's now the time on the show where I start asking you for money. If you love what you're listening to right now, please help KZSU maintain its excellent programming. KZSU is a non-commercial radio station that depends on the support of its listeners to continue broadcasting its diverse range of music shows, sporting events, news, public affairs, and everything else by visiting kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, kzsu.stanford.edu, and clicking on Donate to KZSU, or by emailing our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, kzsu.stanford.edu. You can do your part to make sure our independent sound never dies.
So, Steve, we're back, and thank you for staying through the music break. And let's continue the conversation and turn a little bit to some of these issues of bureaucratic secrecy. Maybe you could kind of go into a little more detail and talk about the information overload and the volume of information that the government produces in terms of not only paper but also data and all of that, and how the volume of information potentially impacts this bureaucratic secrecy notion that you've consistently encountered.
Boy, the U.S. government must be the most prodigious producer of all forms of information, classified and unclassified, in the world. I mean, there's a daily avalanche from all, not so much from the judicial branch, although there is a lot, but from certainly from the executive and also from Congress. You know, that's fine. That's as it should be. I think even the most obscure and seemingly boring information can be of significance and utility to somebody somewhere. So I would not want information to be screened, you know, other than for reasons that we all agree are legitimate and appropriate, including protecting national security, protecting personal privacy, intellectual property, and so forth. What we don't want to see happen is information withheld for no particular reason at all, as is often the case with bureaucratic secrecy, or for pernicious reasons, to try to skew the public policy agenda by withholding information in a self-interested way.
Mm-hmm. I think that latter point is one that I want to explore a little bit in connection with bureaucracy, and maybe just solicit your opinions on a couple of debates that are occurring. The first one is one that I'm sure you're familiar with, which is the basic debate about transparency or security through transparency. The idea that making information public and allowing for public dissemination and study and discussion of information ultimately leads to a more secure environment in the technological sense. What's your opinion of that issue? Do we have or can we have security through transparency?
I think that, you know, that's more of a slogan than it is a policy.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I'm generally sympathetic to it. It as I understand it, it arises from the context of open source software. The idea being that if people are free to examine and critique software, they can develop patches and improvements in such a way that there's a net benefit in security. I think in many cases that is also true in other areas of public policy. You know, I would allow for the possibility that there are exceptions to that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, should all of our, intelligence, data be published, so that, you know, members of the public can review it and analyze it themselves? That probably does not make sense. You know, there, I think it's a sound instinct that needs to be applied with some discretion to real cases.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's merit in the idea, and I think it's proven itself repeatedly. But I don't think it's the answer to all questions.
How does your project go about choosing what areas of information to probe? In other words, how do you choose what projects you take on in terms of making FOIA requests or publishing the information on your blog or what have you?
Yeah. Well, our starting point is, in terms of the heritage of the organization, we are concerned with national security policy. So I tend to do very little about secrecy in, let's say, agriculture or space policy or whatever else it might be.
Mm-hmm.
National security policy is a sufficiently broad field that it gives me plenty to do and without any prospect of exhausting the field.
Right.
Beyond that, I look for areas that are not already being well covered by others. And of course, our major media outlets, whether it's the New York Times or the Washington Post or the LA Times or whoever, San Jose Mercury, they are really the principal venues for uncovering new information, and there's little that we can do by competing with them. So we are looking for areas that are both important but not fully exploited by others. One area we have sort of fixated on has to do with declassification of the intelligence budget total.
Mm-hmm.
In 1997, I filed a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit against the Central Intelligence Agency, which led to the declassification of that budget number for the first time. It was $26.6 billion in 1997. Nowadays, it's believed to be in the neighborhood of $42 or $45 billion, but it remains classified. Interesting that one of the major recommendations of the 9/11 Commission was to reduce secrecy in intelligence and to begin by declassifying the intelligence budget total.
Mm-hmm.
But that has still not been accomplished, and it's something we're trying to do our bit to help make become a reality.
To push back and on that issue a little bit, how do you respond to those who would say that the project is just, I'm using very very blunt words, because I suspect that there are people who would think this, but what is your response to people that say that the project itself, even by publicizing that number, is doing damage to the national security of the United States? And in other words, to put it bluntly, what's your reaction to those that would say that the Government Secrecy Project is impeding the ability of the government to operate itself?
Yeah. I'm open to an argument, and I'm willing to consider the possibility that I have been mistaken. But I'm not open to being browbeaten or, accused of disloyalty or anything like that.
And you're certainly not getting that from me.
I understand.
I'm absolutely clear for the listeners as well.
And if I tell people that if they want to make an argument that a particular document on our website should not be public, I will consider that argument seriously. But if they want to say, oh, you can't post that, it's classified, or you can't post that, it says for official use only, I say, try again. That's not an argument. Tell me a reason, and I will think about it. And in fact, I have removed documents from our website, and I have refrained from publishing documents, including unclassified documents, that I have found that I think do not need to be or should not be in the public domain. We're not anarchists, but we're also not blindly obedient to a classification system that we know is routinely abused.
The classification system is something that I want to touch on, because I know that the Department of Justice, through memoranda, have advocated and implemented these intermediary classifications, if you will, between secrecy and public. And I want to talk about those in a moment in the context of FOIA, but I do want to follow up on the issue of technology before turning to that, which is I had on Alistair Roberts, a professor from Syracuse, who's written an outstanding book called Blacked Out, Government Secrecy in the Information Age, really looking at specifically at technology and its impact on secrecy. And one of the interesting things that he points out in his book is that technology and the very breadth of information that's available by way of the internet that we discussed previously can exaggerate public perception of government secretness. In other words, that it may lead people to conclude, perhaps erroneously, that more or less information is being kept secret than is in fact the case. What's your sense of that idea of technology exaggerating our perception of government secretness?
I think there's something to it. I mean, I think our expectations of access and our expectations of government responsiveness have only grown over the years, to the point that when we do hit a wall of some kind, we're more frustrated than we might have been during the Nashville skyline days, let's say, of the 1970s.
Right.
But it's not entirely a trick of perception. There are real measurable trends which indicate that secrecy is growing. It may also be that there is a net increase in openness simultaneously. In other words, the two may not be mutually exclusive or zero sum. You could have more information steadily being disclosed while more secrets are steadily being created. Both things could be true, and I think both things are in fact true.
The in the remaining about 5 or 6 minutes that we have left, I do want to turn and discuss a little bit FOIA, the Freedom of Information Act. I certainly in being familiar with your work, I know that FOIA is a main avenue, as you mentioned, that you've used and that the project uses to get information. And I also have read and done research in the area of these classifications. Maybe for the benefit of the listener, you could talk a little bit about these new or maybe a better way to put it is altered classifications that have been promulgated recently in an effort to, I can put it cynically and say thwart, but basically exempt documents and information from disclosure under FOIA.
Yeah, well, the classification system, of course, applies to information that is withheld in, rightly or wrongly, in the name of national security, and it's classified as confidential or secret or top secret. These other kinds of controls that you're talking about apply to information that does not meet the standard for national security classification, but that an agency wishes to withhold anyway or for other reasons. And they go by names such as sensitive but unclassified, mm-hmm. or for official use only, or limited official use. There are literally more than 100 such designations, and they have really caused some chaos in public access to government information. In some cases, the information may be exempt from disclosure under the Freedom of Information Act. In other cases, it's probably not exempt. But it, because there are so many of them and they are used by agencies in so many different ways, sometimes legitimately, for example, privacy information is exempt from disclosure under the FOIA, but often illegitimately or arbitrarily, they have really made the information access picture much murkier than it ever was before. And incidentally, there's a process underway to try to reduce those more than 100 different kinds of controls on unclassified information to something like 5 or 6, and I think there's a chance we'll see that policy change made in the course of 2007.
And yeah, and that leads me to my last real question before we wrap up, which is, you mentioned earlier the political abuse element of secrecy. And given that we're heading into what appears to be, what should be a very interesting and contentious presidential race, as well as, of course, the change in leadership in Congress, you are inside the Beltway, to use another cliche, and I'm curious to get your sense of where we're headed in the next year or two in terms of government secrecy and what you see as the main issues that you'll be confronting.
Well, I think it's going to be a very dynamic and interesting time because of the new political constellation. One of the things that has characterized the last several years has been the unwillingness of the Republican-dominated Congress to challenge a Republican administration. And under those circumstances, the executive branch has seized every advantage that it could and has adopted secrecy whenever it could. With the arrival of a Democratic majority, I think we will almost certainly see an end to that complacency and a much more aggressive and demanding posture on the part of the legislative branch. So I think there will be battles, and some of them will produce victories for public access to information. It's going to be interesting to see.
Mm-hmm.
There are different people will have different agendas. I continue to think an important starting place is to declassify the intelligence budget total, to reduce the use of controls on unclassified information, to improve disclosure of information to Congress, including disclosure on a classified basis when necessary.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of things that perhaps should not be made publicly available should still be made available to Congress, the people's representatives, on a classified basis. Very often that has not been the case, and that is something else that may now change.
The climate that we're heading into, I think, lends itself to people learning more about your project and really just trying to get more information, especially given that national security concerns, rightly or wrongly, are cited with increasing frequency whenever policies of any nature, whether they be budget issues or healthcare, education, national security issues, seem to always be, you know, in one way or another involved, given our climate. For the listeners that want to learn more about your project and about what you're doing, I know there's a website, and I want to give you the opportunity to give out that address and offer any other resources that people could turn to.
Sure. Well, almost all of our activity has a web-based component, and it's not hard to find. If you go to the Federation of American Scientists website at fas.org, you'll find a link to government secrecy on the left side. We put out an email newsletter a couple times a week called Secrecy News. that you can subscribe to for free if you're interested. And we have quite an abundance of official and unofficial resources on government secrecy and other aspects of national security policy that are there for your enjoyment.
Steve, I want to thank you so much for being on Hearsay Culture today and talking about your project. Like I said at the beginning, I think it's terrific, and so I want to thank you for taking the time. And again, I've been throwing out cliches all day, but I want to just say keep up the great work, because I am a subscriber to Secrecy News, and I found it immensely valuable in my own research on trade secrecy and public infrastructure, which is a topic that perhaps in the future, if you'd like to come back on the show, that we can explore in a little more detail. But suffice to say, thank you very much for being here today on Hearsay Culture.
Thanks very much.
I want to thank Steve Aftergood from the FAS for being on today again, and can't commend enough his website and his work. Even for listeners that are not overly interested in the details of national security, I can say for anyone that's interested in getting a sense of what's going on in government generally, between the CRS reports I mentioned earlier and the FOIA requests that FAS makes, as well as just news reporting on what's going on in other cases, you really can't find a better resource. I'm very excited to announce this show is being recorded on January 23rd, but by the time this show airs, I can say, I think with certainty, that www.hearsayculture.com has been launched. That is the website dedicated to the show, and I encourage you to go to that website to find not only previous shows, including this one, but also to find resources related to the interviews, links and things like that. So I do encourage you to check the website, and of course, feel free to let me know what you think of the website, pros and cons. You can email me at dlevine@law.stanford.edu. You can also contact me through the website at dave@hearsayculture.com. I'm also very excited at my group of guests that are going to be coming on in the coming weeks. Next week will be Richard Lanham, professor of English at UCLA, who's written a really interesting book called The Economics of Attention. And I'm also looking forward to talking to Julian Dibell, who wrote another great book, a very different book, called Play Money, about his experience actually building a bit of a career selling virtual goods in virtual worlds. So I'm very excited to talk to them. And, of course, you can find the schedule of upcoming guests both on hearsayculture.com and also on the CIS Center for Internet and Society webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. As always, I encourage you to go to CIS's webpage and learn more about the work that we're doing at CIS, and to just really inform yourself on the myriad issues in technology that warrant public concern and public interest. So thanks again to Steve Aftergood for being on the show. Please stay tuned for more programming on KZSU Stanford. Coming up next is Mike with Baptism of Solitude. So thank you for listening today. And do have a great day.